Okay, so like my wife and I would like to fancy ourselves amateur gardeners, emphasis on the word amateur. And we had this little trouble spot in our backyard. We had trouble growing things until we discovered a small little morning glory called Blew My Mind. The little morning glory there is sort of that opens up in the morning with this gorgeous blue color, spectacular blue color, and then closes up during the afternoon at night. But what I learned when I was sort of working in my yard was there are certain things that will grow only in a given kind of soil. And the success of the plant has everything to do with the environment in which it's planted. Most of you know this intuitively. Well, our seminar that we're going to do this evening is mostly about the soil in which the tectonic changes that have taken place in the public discourse about sexuality and gender have been nurtured. In other words, we want to think about this simple statement. I am a woman trapped in a man's body. Had a patient uttered that phrase to a doctor, even some 25 years ago, it would have been understood as an ailment. Now it's, of course, been adopted and actually fiercely defended by large swaths of American society. And so what I want to attempt to do tonight is to answer two simple questions. How did this happen? What was the circumstances surrounding how this happened? And secondly, how do we find our way through this rather massive generational shift? Okay, so the first question I want to talk about is the soil in which this change grew. In November of 2019, that particular issue of GQ magazine featured an opinion column by the editor by the name of Will Welch. And to Welch's credit, he realized that in the midst of the Me Too movement, it's a little bit weird to sort of be a men's magazine, as it were. How do you have that sort of job and talk about manhood at a time in which you're probably not supposed to be talking at all, but actually listening to female voices? That was the question. What I want you to notice, though, for a second is how Welch responds to his understanding of becoming the new editor of GQ magazine. Here's what he says. He says, GQ isn't targeting a conventional demographic at all. We're just doing our own specific GQ thing, our own specific GQ way, and we trust that all kinds of people will relate and engage. Pause there for just a second. You need to hear in his explanation something familiar. GQ, he thinks, needs to be authentic. And the best way to do that is to do things the GQ way. Which he goes on to unpack when he says, this issue is an exploration of the ways that traditional notions of masculinity are being challenged, shifted, and overturned. Hold that thought. Finally, he sums up his mission as editor-in-chief by saying this. He says, I've thought about empathy a lot over the course of editing this issue. And it strikes me that before you can feel what others are feeling, you must first be in touch with how you feel. In other words, you have to have empathy for yourself. And then you can turn that hard-won superpower outward and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It might seem counterintuitive that the people we need to learn to love first and foremost are ourselves, but I believe it's true. Toxicity simply cannot thrive in the golden presence of genuine self-love. What I want you to pay close attention to is the emphasis in Welch's description of what he's doing on the centrality of self. There is no higher value, even to the point of describing it as a golden presence, than loving yourself, being true to yourself, and expressing yourself despite opposition. And what I'm going to suggest to you tonight is that Welch has perfectly described the reigning worldview of our day. And the question is this, what would happen if that kind of thinking entered into the realm of human sexuality? In a very interesting way, I think the editor of GQ magazine is providing for us an amazing example of the philosophical underpinnings that I believe make possible the statement, I feel like a man trapped in a woman's body. The Atlantic Monthly did a profile on a 14-year-old girl that they named Claire, not her real name, who started feeling awkward about her body in the sixth grade. What woman feels awkward about her body in sixth grade, right? How strange. But Claire started watching YouTube videos made by transgender young people. Well, she was very specifically fascinated by a particular channel called Miles Chronicles, the channel of Miles McKenna. Miles is a very charismatic 22-year-old. He has 1 million subscribers who followed him, watched him come out as a trans boy. He went on testosterone, got a double mastectomy, and transformed into a very happy, healthy young man. Claire begins to think to herself, maybe the reason why I'm uncomfortable with my body is because I'm supposed to be a guy, she thinks at the time. Now, what fascinated me about this article was how the story detailed her parents' role in this entire experience for her. Because her mother explained that all of the resources that she found for parents of gender dysphoric children told her that if the daughter says that they are trans, they are trans. And if her daughter said she needed hormones, then it was the parents' responsibility to help her get hormones. The most important thing she could do, she was told, was to affirm her daughter, which they interpreted as meaning they should agree with all of her declarations that she was transgender, even if Claire wasn't quite so certain. Now, interestingly enough, as the article goes, Claire eventually grew out of her awkwardness without having any sort of substantive medical alterations done to her body or hormones. But you need to realize that thousands of young people are either in the midst now of going through transition, they are in the process of researching brand new puberty blockers, they are having double mastectomies, even gender reassignment surgery to alter their bodies to what they believe is their true inner genders. Now, set aside any revulsion you might have for a moment and consider something about the preconditions. I don't know a better way to say this. The preconditions that have to be true for a family even to consider this particular proposition. Because again, 50 years ago, if you go to a doctor and say, I feel like a woman trapped in a man's body, the doctor, of course, would recognize it as an issue, of course. But the issue would have been with your feelings, not with your body. Thus, the answer is to work on the feelings so that they would align with the body. Now, if you say that sentence to a doctor, he still believes it's an issue, but the issue now is with your body. The solution, therefore, is to align the body to match the feelings. And what this tells us is that we're living at a time where our metaphysical realities now have greater authority than our physical realities. In fact, the statement, I feel like a woman trapped in a woman's body, is really almost become an obsolete statement. Now it is, I am a woman trapped in a man's body. The word feel has been replaced with the certainty, I am. Because what I feel now is who I am most essentially. I promise you, once you hear this, you're not going to be able to unhear it around the culture around us. Because every single person in this room, it's actually not just our LGBTQI plus friends. I think that this particular way of seeing the world is true for every one of us. We've all encountered this. Robert Cunningham, again, as I mentioned, the pastor at Takes Creek in Lexington, outlines about 4 areas that we need to consider that we've adopted the same worldview. Consider the way in which you and I conceptualize our vocations. We don't ask the question, is this important work that needs to be accomplished in order for me to be able to establish my own independence? Now we ask, what am I really doing that makes me feel fulfilled in my calling? See the change? Secondly, consider what we do with marriage. No longer do we view marriage by the external vows that we take, but by what am I fulfilled in my marriage? How many divorces have happened simply because someone decided they were no longer happy or felt happy in their marriage? You could consider therapeutic culture. I'm actually a great fan of therapy and counseling, but a good therapist doesn't allow her clients to remain in an endless cycle of introspection, trying to find this elusive inner contentment. The essence of modern therapeutic counseling is, look, go find yourself. You've got to come to peace with you. Now, lest we get condescending to all those people out there, consider also American Christianity and your relationship with Jesus, how you think about it. No longer is a sense of assurance of salvation defined by the external work of Jesus on the cross, but rather my assurance is based on an internal dialogue that I'm having with myself over whether I feel saved. The Christian journey is imagining this very introspective journey, trying to feel saved, trying to feel loved by God, trying to feel with the external Bible and the historical creeds are trying to tell us. In other words, I can't believe that those things are true until I feel that they are true. Okay, so the name that the best minds have given to this particular worldview, and one they're going to work with so you can recognize it when you do any research on it, is expressive individualism. Carl Truman is a philosophy professor in Pennsylvania, and in 2020 he wrote what was probably one of the most important books on the topic, entitled The Rise and Fall of the Modern Self. You've got that in your resources notes at the end of your paper. But there's also a more popular treatment that he did that I would much more highly recommend to you, called Strange New World. It's a condensation of the larger work, where Truman attempts to define expressive individualism this way. Listen to what he says. He says, expressive individualism is the idea that we are at our most authentic or our most genuine when we give outward social, cultural, personal expression to that which we feel inwardly. The real me, if you like, is what lives inside. And to the extent that I'm able to express that outwardly, I realize myself as a genuine person, a genuine self. So Truman goes on to sort of trace what he believes are the dominant thinkers that pushed us in this direction. Bear with me. I don't want to do philosophy one-on-one with you, but it's at least worth noting that thinkers have been walking us through this for quite some time. Truman begins in the 19th century with a philosopher named Rousseau. Truman credits Rousseau with sort of pioneering the internalization of the self. In other words, prior to the 19th century, if you asked someone who they were, they would define that by realities that were outside of them. I am the son of Bill Newsom. I'm a native Memphian. I grew up at Central Church. I'm a ministry candidate, whatever. Christians prior to that time would have said something like, I am who my religion says that I am. That's how they gained a sense of identity. But with Rousseau, Truman argues, the answers turn inward. I now am what my inward impressions say I am. My truest self is a free, autonomous, self-determining individual. Who I am is no longer defined externally, but within the confines of my own internal dialogue. Society threatens to chain me to its definition of me, but I've got to overcome that. More on that in just a second. The second contributor to this thinking, Truman says, is the Romantic period. The Romantic philosophers pushed the fact that we are actually compelled in life far more by our desires than by our thinking. Interestingly enough, I would argue that there was a lot of truth to that, that people do not always change by a process of rational thinking or by sort of reasoned argumentations. People change in general when their desires are captured. We may come back to that sometime in the future. Finally, though, Truman credits Sigmund Freud for then taking that sense of identity and sexualizing it. Freud was adamant that all desires accumulate in a sexual desire, and all desires bow to sexual desire. In other words, who I am as a sexual being is deeply fundamental to my identity. Here's what he says. Freud says, man's discovery that sexual love affords him the strongest experiences of satisfaction, and in fact provides him with the prototype of all happiness, must suggest to him that he should continue to seek the satisfaction of happiness in his life, along the path of sexual relations, and that he should make genital eroticism the central point of his life. In other words, because my sexuality is now me, therefore not to affirm my sexuality is not to not affirm me as a person. You can fiercely disagree with people, right, and still be friends, the best of friends. But if you disagree with the central feature of who I am as a person, you've disagreed with my core identity. You're not disapproving of my opinion. You're not even disapproving of my actions. You are disapproving of my very existence. And you can imagine why people get a little emotional over that particular prospect. Look, what this means is there's some basic tenets of expressive individualism that we can identify. I've got four of them here. Number one, the highest good in life, the reason why you're here is to know and understand yourself. This is an internal psychological journey that only the truly brave really take. Look at how we award them in our society. Number two, once your true internal identity is discovered, my job is to be true to that identity no matter what the cost. In other words, I am most brave when I, quote, speak my truth. Number three, invariably I will experience obstacles along the way. This is absolutely key because the good life is learning to overcome and ignore and vocally reject any obstacles that might keep me from being true to myself. Does that make sense? Hence the cultural heat that gets exchanged around this. And fourthly and finally, these obstacles almost always represent common accepted norms of morality, especially parents and the church. Okay, so look where we are, parents and church right here. Challenging these is essential to the journey into the true self, says the expressive individualist. Again, from Truman. The turn to the psychological self is fundamentally iconoclastic with regard to traditional moral codes, as they are now seen to be part of the problem rather than part of the solution. The word iconoclastic means that it's to tear something down, something that's in the way of you being really authentic. It also means that the battles that we face culturally are almost always going to be over safe spaces, safe places where people can ultimately be authentic. The expressive individualist warrior, therefore, becomes most preoccupied with the language that people use to describe people and movements. This is where the battle for language comes in. For example, Truman says, language becomes much more contested than in the past because words that cause psychological harm will become problematic and will need to be policed and ultimately suppressed. To use pejorative racial or sexual epithets ceases to be a trivial matter. Instead, it becomes an extremely serious act of oppression. This explains why so much outrage in the public square is now directed at what one might call hate speech or speech crimes. Even the relative new term hate speech speaks to this. While earlier generations might have seen damage to the body or property as the most serious categories of a crime, a highly psychologicalized era will accord increasing importance to words as means of oppression. Again, we could go on, but what is the upshot of this first section of our discussion here? First, I simply want to pitch to you that this is the water that we and our children swim in. And there's a danger there. The old joke is about the two fish who encounter an older fish while they're swimming through the sea. The older fish looks at the two fish and is like, "Good morning, boys. How's the water this morning?" Of course, then after that, he sort of swims away. As the two fish are by themselves again, they look at each other and they say, "What in the world is water?" Wow, that was awesome. It was a very funny joke, apparently. That's all right. In other words, when you're a fish and you swim in water all the time, you tend not to notice it. It's too much there. Once you begin to open your eyes to the idea of expressive individualism, you can't unsee it. It's everywhere. And so what it means is our first instincts to address these problems that are associated with the transgender movement are almost always going to be wrong. And here's the reason why. Because usually we'll start explaining and arguing. Presbyterians especially are going to do this. Because you can proof text the questions until the cows come home. But what we're going to find is that every attempt to explain what we mean to someone when we object to their use of a misgendered pronoun or maybe their insistence upon letting someone be free to make their own decision is going to be met not only with immediate irrelevancy, but with every passing year, it seems, with more aggression and more ostracization, invariably. So secondly, I think it says to us that we are at a time in which we need to change our tactics. which is why Robert Cunningham was so compelling to me when he suggests that what we need to do in the face of our present identity crisis in this world concerning gender is to begin to tell a better story about our human sexuality, and especially about the nature of love itself. So my goal tonight is not to go through and take the pieces of the transgender movement apart piece by piece. I'm trying to introduce you to the ground on which it's not going to be fought, in order to say, there is a way through this mess, I think. But it's going to be through us telling a better story about our own human sexuality from the Bible's point of view. And what I think you're going to discover is there is beauty in the way in which the Bible lays out human sexuality that oftentimes we don't pay much attention to. Because you got to understand that if you go searching for people who have thought carefully about how to talk to our children about these kinds of issues, I think you're going to be frustrated. Most of the Christian resources that you'll find, especially when it comes from our evangelical and Protestant camp, are preoccupied with the prohibitions of sex. How to remain pure, how to avoid temptations, how to put pornography blockers on your phones and your computers. In other words, it's primarily a negative approach to human sexuality. And the problem with that pure prohibition approach to thinking about sex is that eventually our young people begin to feel the pull as being way too strong. It's very easy, the older we get, to forget how inevitable sexual desire feels when you're an adolescent. A fact, interestingly enough, is built into our spiritual DNA. We are supposed to experience erotic desire in that particular way. But generally speaking, our young people, in my opinion, are really only given two options in this life, especially as it comes from the church. Either indulge in sexual temptations and give yourself to them in this ever-present porn-soaked culture, or you can go on a decade-long fast from any sexual experience at all. Those are the two options. Catholic theologian Christopher West, in his book A Theology of the Body, said this. He says, a person can starve himself for only so long before the choice becomes clear. Either I find something to eat, or I'm going to die. This is why the culture's fast food gospel, the promise of immediate gratification through indulgence of desire, inevitably wins large numbers of converts from the starvation diet gospel. That's what we're sort of delivering. West goes on to say that what we have to do with our young people is not make repression the only avenue of thinking about sexual desire. Here's what he says again. He says, my impression growing up was wrong. Christ doesn't want us to repress our desires. Rather, he wants to redeem our desires, to heal them, to redirect them toward an infinite banquet of love and ecstatic bliss called the marriage supper of the Lamb that we read about in Revelation 19. Now, my question is, what exactly is West talking about here? Redirect my children to what? What are you talking about? What West is getting at is what also Robert Cunningham picked up, which is when you begin to sort of give a better story about our sexuality to our young people, there's actually a hope of them having something more than just two choices of either total abstention, which means that I can never, never think about it, never, never look at it, something that goes completely contrary to their hormonal life, or on the other hand, giving themselves to it and giving full voice to whatever feeling or desire comes up out of me. Is there a better story? I think there is. And I want to organize into three headings. And this is what I'm getting from Robert Cunningham really from here on out. We want to look at the origin of sexuality in the Bible, the destruction of sexuality, and then the destiny of sexuality. Bear with me. First of all, the origin of sexuality. The story of human sexuality really begins in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. When God says this, let us make man in our image after our likeness. Think about what you have here. You have the Trinitarian God who is deciding to make creatures to reflect the reality of his own being. He did not do that with the animals. Rather, what he did was he made human beings moral. We have a sense of justice. We have a sense of what goodness and truth and beauty are. Not only that, animals mate. humans very literally make love. And here's my question. Why do we say it that way? Why has that become the common parlance for that? Well, this is what the Bible suggests to us. It's because God is a Trinity. Three persons, one essence. In other words, we do not say that God is divided up into parts, right? Nor did he shift form with changing epochs of human history. Those are two false church heresies, interestingly enough. God has always existed as a complete and sufficient being in himself. So he creates in order to have someone to share, to connect to his own self-sufficient being. He does not create out of a sense of need. And in order to give humans, these image bearers, this vision of exactly what the love between the persons of the Trinity is, sex is created. Robert Cunningham says that erotic love is the closest that we ever come to grasping the God whose image we bear. The Trinity exists in an eternal exchange of love, not boring, sappy, Hallmark puppy love, but a deep, fulfilling, rapturous ecstasy of eternal exchange of endless bliss. Wes says this. He says, the body is not only biological. The body, as John Paul II unfolds in great detail, is also theological. It tells an astounding divine story, and it does so precisely through the mystery, this is key, of sexual difference and the call for the two to become one flesh. This means that sex is not just about sex. Hold that thought. We're about to dive into that big time. I realize that we're uncomfortable talking about God in these terms because we have a distorted view of sex. We're not trying to sexualize the Trinity. Rather, what I'm saying is that the Trinity has given us sex as a glimpse into the Trinity, which is to experience this eternal exchange of love and forever sharing and receiving of love's ecstasy. There's no way you have a book like the Song of Solomon in the Bible and not have a God who is passionate about erotic love. But this is where the story gets important, because Genesis 1 stresses that there is a great sameness between man and God. He's created in his image. Man reflects God's image. But in Genesis chapter 2, we find that the only way in which he can adequately reflect that image is through dissimilarity. This is fascinating. It's really interesting. Why? Because the image is incomplete. What does God say? It is not good that man should be alone. So while Adam sleeps, God removes his rib and he makes a woman. Christopher West sees this as significant. He says, first of all, men are made from dust, which is why their bodies are gross. Women are made from the already made man. Eve is the only creature not made from dust, but from another creature. And there's a real case to be made that the full apex of the glory of God is the image of God, certainly. But if you want to nuance it further, if you really want to define it, Eve comes out of the image, not dirt. So that she is the highest glory in all of creation, physically speaking, and that the female body is the greatest beauty in all of creation. Every human culture that you know to man has been infatuated with the innate glory and beauty of the female body. If you go back and look at artistic expression for centuries, you'll see people fascinated with the female body. Look, the Trinity, though, is one essence, three persons. Eve is now the same essence as Adam, but a distinct person. See? The Trinity's echoes come out even in that. And notice the bodily influence in Adam's response to Eve. This is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. In other words, Adam sees in the naked female form of Eve something of himself, not just in the biology of her body, but in the theology of her body. And the story of his body only makes sense when he sees her body. So what is it that he sees? Well, he sees that just about everything in their bodies is almost exactly the same, except for one place in particular. They have remarkably similar features, except in one place. There's only one place where Adam's body doesn't make sense, and Eve's body doesn't make sense if they're by themselves. This goes down as deeply even as to the cells of their body. Thousands of years later, humans would discover that the body has 46 chromosomes with one exception. The sperm cells have 23, the ovum has 23. And what's crazy is you have, therefore, in the image of God's picture of human sexuality, the human genitals telling the story of a Trinitarian exchange of eternal love better than anything else in the creation could. This is what Wes says. Bear with me. The heavens declare the glory of God, but the genitals declare the love of God. They declare that love when they come together and the two shall become one flesh. In other words, there is in the Christian conception of sexuality a profound sacredness to sexual union. And every human knows it. You want to know why? Because we're the only creatures that instinctively cover our genitalia. Your dog, I'm assuming, could not care less. They run through the neighborhood flaunting it all out there. You and I, though, cover our genitals. Why? Because we know that it's holy. And secondly, because we know that it needs protection. And my question to introduce my second point is, how do we know that? Why do we know that our genitals need protection? That brings me to the second point, and that is the destruction of sexuality. Because look, as glorious as all this is, there's a reason I think that we know that our genitals instinctively need protection. The reason is because they're threatened. This is where the story turns tragic, because this spectacular design for sex has been destroyed. If not destroyed, it's been radically redirected into something that doesn't sort of build us up, but actually hurts us instead. Think about what happens in Genesis chapter 3. After mankind disobeys God, the Bible says their eyes were opened and they knew that they were naked. It's very interesting how the verse puts it. It's not that they were blind before. What is it that changed? Well, Genesis 3 says that they sewed for themselves loincloths. That's the key. Because look, before in Genesis chapter 2, the genitals were celebrated. That's what Adam's doing at the end of chapter 2. Now, instinctively, both Adam and Eve know that their genitalia needs to be protected. Now, the question is, what could they possibly need protection from? Wes says that the love now that was supposed to exist between the two of them has now been replaced with lust. Lust changes sex into something that it was never intended to be. Sex was supposed to be this act of selflessness, giving your body to another to make something that is incomplete by yourself, but complete only with another. Sex used to be a window into the reality that is God. Now, sex is a mirror reflecting your own authoritative desires back to you. That's the shift. Sex was given to show this eternal exchange of love between the Godhead. And therefore, the exchange of love has now been replaced by the exploitation of lust. You see it immediately what lust did. It creates a power struggle between the man and the woman, does it not? In other words, where once they were selflessly giving each themselves to each other, now they selfishly demand each other's service. It was this woman you gave me. So follow the story. If sexual union was the most vivid example of the union and communion of the members of the Trinity, then what better place for the devil to distort than sex, where lust becomes the most powerful wrecking ball into a God-centered life? I've counseled student after student who, when they're confronted by their own sexual failures, have come to pray, especially during times of confession during church, as if their sexual struggle is really the only interesting thing about them. It's so much in their forefront. Why? Because sex is that powerful, and it brings that much shame, because we know intuitively that it's supposed to be. So it's only with that backdrop can you address the sexual dysfunction in our day. We have to deal with the tyranny of pornography. Technology, I would argue, is not the problem. The efficiency with which the internet has delivered pornography is the problem. The problem is how pornography redirects sex away from selfless love to inward selfish lust. Pornography, Cunningham says, is sex with your idol, which is the reason why it can be so incredibly shame-producing and the reason why we have to deal so very carefully with those who are struggling with sexual sin. Incredibly carefully. The technological proliferation of pornography means that almost every cultural boundary that existed for anybody over the age of 50 is now completely been removed. that would keep people from indulging in their habit. And I think there's a case to be made, we can talk about this during the Q&A, that we have to lobby for the regulation of this particular stuff, but I digress. Secondly, we also find that the example is we now have sexualized identities. You know, notice how subtle this is? I said before that now our identities are fundamentally sexualized. Look, we agree that sex goes very deeply into my psyche, but with it redirected back at me, what it means is I am drowned in my own sexual thoughts. Therefore, whenever my sexual desires take me, must be essential to my personhood. Look, the entire LGBTQ plus movement is built upon this false premise. Please understand it. The problem is in how they come to grasp that particular identity. And until we address this pattern of thinking, your arguments are going to fall on deaf ears and will always sound incredibly aggressive. The transgender movement's insistent that gender determines sex is simply the next very tragically consistent step in the logic. Christians have got to hold a line, I would say. Sex determines gender. Gender does not determine sex. Now, my sexuality is me instead of it being a part and an extension of me. Which leads, thirdly and finally, to the devalued sexuality. Think about it. The devil wants to rob God of his glory. What better way to do that than to devalue the image bearer's genitalia? Find it really interesting and tragically consistent that as I was getting off campus, I would hear college students talking about their genitals as their junk. I thought that's a fascinating slang term for us to come up with. And that's not just filthy talk. Statistically, we are experiencing an eye-popping pandemic of sexless marriages. Teen pregnancies have plummeted for the last decade, plummeted to lower rates than it ever was prior to the 60s. In other words, once you accept lust as the basic currency of sexuality, then the market's going to crash because it's failure to deliver. Teen sex is down. Teen pregnancies are lower. Why? Not because they're exercising better choices about sex, but because they have internalized sexual identity that has resulted, irony of ironies, in its devaluation. If you were the devil, you're dancing a jig over being able to accomplish that. It's very much in keeping with judgment that sexuality is removed rather than being redeemed. Brings me thirdly and finally to the last one, because it's not a complete story, because there is a destiny to our sexuality as well. In the New Testament, Jesus has a very fascinating, if not unnerving, exchange with the religious liberals of his day that we know as the Sadducees. These are people who did not believe in the resurrection at all. And so when they try to do the trick question thing on him, he replies that people in the new heavens and the new earth are neither married nor are they given in marriage in the new heavens and new earth. What in the world could Jesus possibly mean by that? Well, in the interest of time, I'll state it rather abruptly. We will not be married to each other and we won't marry each other because we will be married to God. In the new heavens and the new earth, the bride of Christ is married to the bridegroom Jesus, meaning we will marry into the family. And at that point, we have to ask the question, who cares about sex? We get to lean in on that which sex has always pointed toward. The image, the symbol, gives way to the reality, and our destiny is to step up into that eternal exchange of the love of God forevermore. Look, follow the story here. Humans ruined sex in the fall. But the storyline of the scripture is that God is going to use sex to win the cosmic battle between Satan and himself. I'm fascinated by this thought. In Genesis 3:15, Eve is promised that as generation after generation engages in erotic love, there will eventually be salvation that is yielded from it. From your seed, from your offspring, God says to Eve, will come one who will crush the head of Satan. So therefore, countless male and female unions will come to bring about the Messiah that will save the world. That's the promises of Genesis 3:15. And this is so essential to establish with our children. Genitals determine gender, not the other way around. We are to use our genitals to bring about the generations that will save the world. Notice, all of those words come from the root word gen, which means to be born, to begat. In other words, there's a sense in which in the Bible's understanding, man, this is huge, he's going to save the world through childbearing, which is the reason why Christians have always looked at it as sacred. You don't believe me? Let me give you a couple examples. What was the covenant sign that God gave to Old Testament men to show they were in the covenant? We called it circumcision. And every generation, God would say, is going to bear a bloody sign. Why? Because one of those male parts is going to deliver a sacred seed that is going to bring to the woman that's going to bring the Savior of the world. And that's the reason why. Because you got to think about it. That's a weird way of distinguishing yourself as a person, circumcision. Why? Because God is saying, because that area is important. And bleeding there is fundamental to what we need to understand about what God is doing in the world. In other words, all that says, though, is that the seed is nothing without a womb, which is why the womb is the most hated enemy of Satan. I will put enmity between you and the woman, God says. It's the woman that the devil wants, which is one of the reasons why throughout the Old Testament you have this theme of barrenness that is so often told. Satan is trying to stop the coming seed, but what does God do? Over and over again, whether it's Sarah or Rachel or Hannah, he overcomes barrenness so that his promises can continue. Look, for this reason, a woman's body is sacred in a special way. At the curse in Genesis 3, God says he's going to increase the woman's pain in childbearing, which I realize to many ears seems rather arbitrary and irrational. Why would God do that? It's not meaningless. Because every month, a female body will bleed as a way of proclaiming that only a bleeding body is going to save. During her time of the month, her menstrual period, said Leviticus, a woman is unclean, fascinating, testifying to the one that was going to suffer and be unclean and cut off themselves. You see the point? And of course, when a woman gives birth, there is a flood of blood. The only time I've ever been queasy and almost passed out was when I was there for my children's birth. And I was close I ever came to getting woozy. But there's the messiness of a bloody birth that yields new life. That's exactly what Jesus did on the cross. Don't you see it? Every menstrual period, every birth, it's been proclaiming God's redemption by sex from the very beginning. And the truth is, we could go on and on and on. Why was Jesus crucified naked? Every gospel writer writes about Jesus being crucified. Why would you include that? Unless he's bearing some of our shame and nakedness there. Why is it that when he left us with a meal, he says, this is my body, which is for you? We could go on and on. Look, in the new heavens and the new earth, a holy city is coming down, and it is adorned as a what? As a bride. There's no marriage in heaven because we'll be married to God, which means that every single one of us uniquely embodies the beauty that Jesus has designed for salvation, and it has happened in our sex parts. This is why this is worth us telling different stories to our children. We have to tell our story and stop arguing about this and simply equip them with a story that's got infinite more glory. I literally was just watching a show, some Netflix thing, and it was about a man and a woman who had an affair. And for whatever reason, the wife decides to stay with the man who had an affair. But the way he explains his affair is like, it was just sex. It was just sex. At every turn, there's a devaluation of sex in these things. If we present something, though, more beautiful than the degraded and demeaning version of sex that porn is offering us, then finally maybe we'll have a chance of introducing something more glorious to our children. We have to start telling something different about our bodies, or else our objection to their gender-erasing arguments are going to fall on deaf ears. It also means that there's a lot of reform that we need even in our own marriages. I don't have time to get into this. There's some notes there in your notes. But I do think there's something about even in our sex lives and our marriage needs to be looked at in a very fresh way, and about the exchange that goes on before we achieve true eroticism and ecstasy and the theology of that moment between the two of us, right? Okay, that ends my presentation. And the hopes that there would be some time for us to ask questions. I realize that's a lot of material. Glad some of you are able to follow along in some of the notes.